Come to the 64th annual OA birthday party. Together, we get better. In person, January 12th through 14th at the LAX Hilton in Los Angeles, California. Meet fellows from across the globe for a weekend-long extravaganza of workshops, panels, special interest speakers, entertainment, fellowship, laughs, and recovery. Highlights include body image workshop, weekend-long big book study, sober eating workshop, keynote speakers with unique stories, dance party and comedy show, yoga and meditation, meetings and meetups for LGBTQIA, BIPOC, Spanish language, young people, and AAPI members, plus a boutique where you can shop till you drop. Registration is now open at oabirthday.com. Staying the night? Book your room now at a discounted rate through the oabirthday.com website and act fast because rooms sell out quickly. There is a solution. You'll hear from speakers who have various versions of this disease who live happy, joyous, and free. Because together, we get better.
Welcome to the OA Virtual Kitchen Sink Meeting Podcast. Visit the Los Angeles Intergroup at oalaig.org for information on how to join our meeting live and how to donate to support this meeting and our podcasts. The opinions expressed on the Kitchen Sink podcast are those of the individual speakers and do not represent OA as a whole. And now, our speaker.
Hi, I'm Sam, a compulsive overeater from the other side of the country. I'm from Connecticut. I just wanted to say thank you guys so much for giving me the opportunity to really clarify my program and put it into perspective. And that program is what's saving my life. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to do it in terms of a song that I heard. It was amazing. The song is called, it's by the Eagles, and the song is called Already Gone. And the verse that really describes my journey is, we live our life in chains and we don't realize we have the key. Okay, so now let's start from the beginning. Here's my background in OA. Why am I coming to these meetings? Well, basically, because I had a body that couldn't handle the way I was engulfing food and a mind that couldn't handle reality. I was literally killing myself with food. And I saw many family members do this and even friends in OA. My father died at age 64 from diabetic complications. And my grandfather, who I'm named after, died at age 58. So what I did is I took a picture of his footstone. And whenever I get complacent and don't feel like working my program, I look at that. And I know that if I don't watch out, that's exactly where I could wind up. So now, how do I not wind up there? Well, what I'm trying to do is build a life worth living, a life that I don't have to escape from, and to be able to live it on life's terms, not Sam's terms. All right, now let's see, do I qualify? Okay, well, I got up to over 500 pounds. I had a 52-inch waist. I was a very dangerous diabetic. In fact, I lost a couple segments on two toes because of my diabetes. But what's amazing is that's it. My higher power was looking out for me, even when I wasn't in OA, because besides those little amputations, and some arthritis, and of course the hanging skin, that's it. All of my eyes, my organs, everything is fine. And so basically, where am I now? Well, now I'm down to about 223 pounds with a 42-inch waist and a healthy A1C. And I've been abstinent from my foods, alcoholic foods and food behaviors since April 1st of 2019. And to be honest, it was a couple of days before that. But I don't really count the days that I'm abstinent. I like April 1st because, as we all know, it's April Fool's Day. And that, to me, is the last day that I was fooling myself about food. And now in terms of the physicalness, when I used to lie on my side at 500 pounds, it was like I had a conjoined twin attached to me. And now when I lie on my side, it's as if that conjoined twin has been removed. So let's get back into my family of origin. You know, is this disease nature or nurture? Who cares? I have the damn thing and I'm going to have it for the rest of my life. My family was all about eating. We were all compulsive overeaters. It was a major thing. In fact, the only positive times I can remember in my family was around food, going on vacations. Where were we going to eat? All of that other stuff. And even holidays. it wasn't about getting together with everybody. It was like, all right, she's going to make this dish. She's going to make that dish. Of course, is there going to be enough? And then me was, am I going to fit in my damn suit or not? Because I remember vividly, somebody told me my earliest recollection, of a compulsive overeater was at age 3. I went to this picnic. My grandfather picked me up and I said, put me down. They're going to eat all the food. So somehow at age 3, I was worried about not getting enough food. And then, of course, always having to go to that special section of the store to get the husky clothes. But you know what the worst thing was, is I would be eating at a place as a kid, eating and eating. And my parents would loudly say, Sam, stop. And that was just so embarrassing. And I knew that they loved me and they were only doing it because they were worried about my health. But still, it was very embarrassing. And my size is what really ruled my social life growing up through adolescence. When I was big, I felt like I didn't deserve to be around anybody, that I had to hide in shame in the corner. However, when I was down, then I thought that I could participate, that I was worthy of other people. And then, of course, the fun of breaking furniture. And I, to be honest, my all-time low was I was up at school, the University of Connecticut, and I really wanted to eat. And I was so embarrassed that I went into the math building in the men's stall and was eating because I didn't want anybody else to see me eat. Now let's get to the emotionally. Emotionally, my family, we were basically emotionally neglected. All of us. Nobody discussed emotions. I didn't even know what the hell an emotion was. I thought an emotion was a hunger pain. So I stuffed it down. And I heard this in a meeting and it made a lot of sense to me that my emotions were stuck in my fat. And now that my fat is gone, it's like these little bastards are going crazy and I need a program to learn how to deal with that. And then in order to make up for my inadequacies, I use in step 4, you know how you guys call it the defects of character? Well, I don't call it that because my whole life I've been coming from a deficit. I call them my self-destructive life survival skills. You know, the skills that I needed to survive in life. For example, I always thought I had to be perfect. I thought if I was perfect, you weren't going to see all of my inadequacies. And then how did I do this socially? I became a chameleon. I would act differently in different situations. I also became a world-class bullshitter. I would tell people what they wanted to hear. The other thing was I always took the path of least resistance. That happened with my marriage, which I'll get to in a little later point, my career choices, all of that. And then we get to the fun of expectations. My parents really never had expectations on me because I did their job for them. Somehow in my mind, I had these high expectations. You know, what I thought other people were my expectations. They never told me this. I put that on them. And I said, I put them so high that I could never obtain them. And when I didn't meet those expectations, then I came to resentments. Was I resenting you? Mostly it was resenting myself. And then guess what? Those resentments went right to wanting to eat or to do some of those self-destructive life survival skills. Okay, so I got into OA the late 80s when I was still up at school. I only thought of it as a diet club. I only worked the first leg of the stool, just the physical. So I lost all my weight and I left. And when you're 500 pounds and you're on a one-legged stool, guess what? You fall on your rear end. And I did. Because getting back a little bit to that family of origin, food was equated with love. That's how we showed our affection. So I guess at 500 pounds, I loved myself a lot. And then in the fall of 2018, my life came crashing down. My mother and my wife both died within 3 weeks of each other. And I didn't know what to do. I was almost catatonic. And all I was doing was eating and eating. And luckily, I had this friend from the the late 1980s when I first got into OA, and she became a sister, like an honorary member of the family, Well, she was such a pain in the pita, you know what that is? A pain in the ankle, that she said, all right, Sam, you got to go to OA. You got to go to OA. So what I did is, since that coping mechanism of people pleasing was bigger than that coping mechanism of shame, I went back to OA. And it was really hard because I thought you all were going to look at me and say, damn, what the hell happened to you? You blew up like a balloon. But you know what? Nobody did that. All they did was say, Sam, I'm just so glad to see you. And that gave me so much strength. And as you can imagine, I had so much self-loathing and hatred. And the beautiful thing is that you guys taught me that I'm a good person and that I'm worth doing work on myself. So you actually taught me to love me before I could love myself. But now going back to OA, it was kind of tough because I go in the meeting and I see people, oh, I've lost 100 pounds. I've lost 200 pounds. I've been abstinent for all these years. So I was thinking, oh, my God, I got to do that right away. And basically, I was a kindergartner in class and these guys had PhDs. So I had a ton of that compare and despair coping mechanism where I would look at what you did and think, I got to do that. And if I'm not doing it, that's what led to the despair. And then I was in it for about 9 months and I thought I could get the program through osmosis, you know, just sitting there and it was all going to come in. Well, it didn't. And I even recall hearing things in the meeting that kind of triggered all of the reasons why I ate. I would actually eat afterwards because I didn't know what to do with those feelings. So it took me about 9 months before I could become abstinent. And then I decided that, all right, sitting here doing nothing isn't going to help anything. I have to start taking action. So then I kind of figured out, what are some of the keys to my program? Being willing, not willful, being teachable, taking action, realizing that, guess what? I can tolerate discomfort. I don't have to push it down. Where I ever got that notion that I couldn't tolerate discomfort, I'll never know. And so those chains, you know, that I was talking about, those chains are really tight. And you guys were starting to give me the key. And so I looked at, okay, what are some of the keys that I can put into that lock? The first thing I had to do is I had to put down the food. And for me, the program, my physical abstinence is 10% of my program. However, it's the first 10%. Because if I'm in the food, I'm lost. It's kind of like being in a war zone where there's a deep, dense fog. And if I'm in that fog, aka being in the food, I can't see where to run to, where to get solace, where to get comfort. But if I put that food down, the fog is lifted. But guess what? Life can still be like a war zone. At least now I have the skills and I can know where to run to and how to get help. And now this is how I figured out what my issues were with food. My sponsor had me do this inventory. He said do it in 5-year increments. But I'll be honest, when I was 2 years old, I don't remember what I was eating. So what it was is it was a list of the way that I was eating in a self-destructive manner or the way that I was embarrassed to see people see me eat. So I made a list of all those foods, and especially the food behaviors. And the biggest key for me was putting in my feelings afterwards, my feelings of misery and disgust and self-loathing. So this way, when I want to eat something, I refer back to that list. Because if you tell me, all right, Sam, you can't eat this, that's just going to make me want to eat it even more. And if you say, okay, don't think about it, it's kind of like, look, if there's a pink elephant in the room, and I tell you not to look at it, what are you going to do? You're going to look at the damn pink elephant. So what for me was, is when I wanted to eat one of those foods or I had a craving, I would go back to that list and I would look at the misery and disgust. And I would look at that picture of my grandfather's footstone. And I would think, all right, that would taste good. That would alleviate some of this stuff. But I don't want to go there. I don't want to be 6 feet under. Not yet. So that's how I was able to put some of the cravings down. Now, let's be honest. I still get food thoughts, but because of my spiritual fitness, I don't get the cravings. And I'm very grateful for that. And then I had to come up with the biggest component for me that I didn't work before. And that was the spiritual component. And I was kind of lost with that. I grew up and I was in a very dogmatic, formalized praying. And I was praying in a different language. I didn't know what the hell I was saying. I just memorized the verses. So I knew there was something bigger than me, but, you know, that was about it. But then everybody's saying, all right, Sam, you need help to get through this. Yeah, I have all of you, but I need something 24/7. So I had to come up with my own higher power, not the one that all of you had. So what I did is I did a list of all the attributes that I'd want if there was something bigger and stronger than me. You know, I was just testing it out kind of like in step two. And then I had to come up with a name. And I came up with a name. It just so happens that it's a religious name, and I wasn't going for that. I came up with the name Hashem. And the reason why I like that is because it's so therapeutic and smooth and soothing when I say that, that throughout the day I can say, Hashem, please help me. I cannot do this on my own. And then I really had to think about, all right, I got to have a partnership or a relationship with this person. I have to be able to internalize it. So every day I wake up in the morning and I say, you know, thank you for allowing me to wake up. But then there's also more to it. I realize that my higher power has faith in me because I call all of you my higher power with skin, and my higher power wants me to be higher, would to be to help other people. So it's not only, you know, thank you, it's also thank you for having faith in me. And that's been a huge thing. And to realize that, excuse me?
Sam, you have 5 minutes.
Okay, so that higher power wants me to thrive and not just survive. So we're talking about some of the keys, like the key was the spiritualness. The other key are going to meetings. The other keys are talking with all of you and really integrating all that stuff. There's only one issue here. That's just do for me. It's doing it on an intellectual basis. So if the key is in the lock, guess what? The change is still there. The lock is still on. What required next was for me to have faith and to trust. So that's what I've been trying to do, and to actually turn that key. And that's what unreases the lock. And what helps keep me in a recovery is the environment. Because I've seen other people, or let's say, be basic, prisoners who go to prison for a while. When they come back, and if they're in that same environment, guess what? They're going to reoffend. So I've had to build a support network and an environment that supports me, so I'm not going to want to get back into my disease. I've met a lot of people who have lost the amount of weight that I have and others, so that helps me with that aspect. And I also have a close-knit group of guys. There's about four or five of us. We call it our squad. So this way, if something is going on, I can call those people. And the big thing is that if one person isn't there, I just call the next. And then I had to learn another lesson. If I just leave a message and say, hi, this is Sam from OA, I'm just making an outreach call, you guys aren't going to know I'm struggling. So what I have to do, even though it's difficult, to say, look, I'm struggling, man. I need your help. And then what's amazing is they come back. They call me. That's another reason with the meetings. I have to go to meetings all over the country, because if it's 11 o'clock here, a lot of people are sleeping. But if I have people that I know in California, they're up and it's only 8 o'clock. So this way I'm covered. I'm covered with my higher power who's there 24/7, and I'm covered with people that I can reach out to. So a lot of this is just having the faith and the acceptance that things are going to be better. And the biggest thing that it's been helping me do is to get away from those unrealistic expectations in my past. Because if I live in my past, I'm still going to have all of that shame and all of that failure. And as hard as it is, I try to just put it down. I say, higher power, I can't do this. So when I get those problems, it's kind of like dropping it, saying, here, higher power, please help me. And what that's been able to do is to help me define myself not by what I am, those unrealistic expectations, or my comparing and despairing about somebody's wealth or station in life, to who I am. And I really feel that I'm becoming a compassionate and caring person. And I'll be honest, I'm going to be 56 in a month. My life is expanding. It's the best that it's ever been. I'm even getting ready to go back into a relationship. And I'm realizing the relationship, it's going to be to complement me. In other words, it's the icing on the cake. It's not the cake. And because if it is the main thing in my life, I'm going to fall into those coping mechanisms of, oh my God, did they call, that external validation, all of that stuff, which is going to lead to resentment, which is going to lead to me going back to abusing my body with food. So I am just so grateful for this. And I am so grateful for this opportunity to help me really look at my program and to clarify it and to kind of put it in order. So again, thank you guys very much. This is the time for questions only. There is no sharing at this meeting. If you need to share, please do so with any one of us after the meeting. Also, please remember that the opinions of the leader are my own and are not those of Overeaters Anonymous as a whole. When asking questions, you need not identify yourself. If you ask a question last week, please wait until the first three questions have been asked before raising your hand. If you have a question, please click the raise hand icon.
Hi, Sam. Thank you for your wonderful share. I'm Cheryl, and I'm a compulsive overeater. You spoke a lot about perfectionism and compare and despair and self-loathing. Do you still struggle with it? As a practical matter, if you do still struggle with it, what do you do?
Oh, okay. Thank you. You know, that's interesting. When I first came in, I thought that those coping mechanisms were going to be gone. And if they weren't gone, that meant I wasn't working my program. And now I've kind of realized that it's about harm reduction. It's, doing less harm to myself and less harm to others. So when I do that, when I'm working my program, I may default back into the perfection like I did before the speech. So what I do is I try to work my program and I call other people, and I figure recovery for me is the shorter amount of time I stay in it. And luckily I'm only staying in it for about 5-10 minutes and then I can go on. And when I have these issues, I use what is called the 3 P's, where if something comes up, I pause. And that for me means postpone action until serenity emerges. And then I try to see what's going on outside of me, not what's in my mind, because that's all biased. And that's called checking the facts. And then what I do is I look for my vulnerabilities, you know, the hungry, angry, lonely, tired. And then, all right, so I'll pray. That's the second P. And if I don't get an answer, I call one of you because you're my higher power with skin. And then I get the answer. Is it always what I want to hear? No, but it's what's going to keep me in recovery. And then I proceed.
Bob M.
Thank you for your share, Sam. That was phenomenal. Do you have a daily ritual? And what is it? If you could explain it. Thank you.
Certainly. When I wake up in the morning, I thank my higher power for allowing me to wake up. And then what I do is I say, thank you for having faith in me. And what I have to do to make sure I start on a positive note is I do 5 gratitudes. And then in order to work on my low self-esteem, I do at least 5 I statements, you know, like I am kind, I am whatever, because I've basically had enough of not being enough. And then what I'll do is I'll go through the steps in my mind. Like I'll say, I'm powerless over food. My life is unmanageable. Powerless over people, places, and things in my life is unmanageable. And the key is I say, I am not powerless over working my program. And I'll do that with all of those coping mechanisms. And then I go to step 2, where I say, you know, higher power, thank you. And just basically say, look, I'm not the higher power. And then I go to step 3, and I have to ask for the willingness not to the willingness to be willing. Because what it is for me, it's kind of like a yo-yo where my self-will or my will is the cylinder part. And I'll throw that cylinder out to my higher power to get his will. But you know what? I'm human. And if I don't like it or it feels uncomfortable, that string is attached to my hand like the yo-yo and I yank it back. What happens then is I fall on my rear end and I have to attribute it to an AFCO. You know what an AFCO is? It's another flipping growth opportunity. And luckily, my higher power loves me unconditionally and doesn't say, all right, Sam, you didn't take my advice. Screw you. You know, he's still there. So what I do is I really do those three steps over and over. And I basically go through all of them in my mind before I get out of bed.
Thank you so much for your share, Sam. It was lovely. I'm sorry, can you go over the three P's again? It was pause, pray, and what was the last one?
Proceed.
Thank you, my friend.
Frank.
Good. The first three questions were asked. Now I can ask another one. Great share, Sam. Thank you so much for being here. And I got a lot out of heard you share before. And I was especially focusing on this, the tolerating discomfort, you know, learning to deal with pain. And I'm a firm believer of all 12-step programs being pain management clinics, you know, because that's kind of where I always ran away from to my diseases. And can you talk a little bit about what that process is for you today? I mean, when the discomfort comes, of course, you know, we learn the concept of acceptance and they can't undo what's come up. What's the next steps when it does? I know you refer to the three P's and that helps, but maybe to expand a little bit upon how you learn to get through with the discomfort and the pain of life.
Okay, when something does come up like that, first, I have to move on from the anger of why is this happening to me? And remember that I've kind of switched my mind from the victimization role of why is things happening to me and to try and focus on, okay, why is this happening for me? What can I do differently out of this and how can it affect my life? So the pain will come up and I'll realize that it's like, all right, Sam, you're feeling pain. It's okay. It doesn't mean you're a bad person. This happens to everybody. And then I ask my higher power, I'd say, I'm feeling this. I don't know what to do with this. So then what I do is I picture like I have this hot lava rock in my hand and I drop it and I give it over to my higher power. And then what I'll do is then I'll use some of my tools to move on from it. I guess the biggest thing is accepting that life does have pain and that it is okay and that it's not a reflection on me. And to realize that pain comes and goes and ebbs and flow. And the thing for me is to let it come and go and ebb and flow instead of trying to stop it. Because if I try to stop it, it's just going to intensify. It's kind of like things in a pressure cooker. So it's a process. Some days are easier than others and some life events are easier than others. So basically, I try to use it as a learning experience. And like I said before, it's that whole harm reduction, allowing it to do less harm to me than it used to be. And that still means I'm in recovery, even though I have those thoughts or I got to get rid of this. I can't handle this. I got to go spend. I got to go eat all of that stuff.
Deb.
Thank you so much, Sam. It was beautiful. Can you talk a little bit about the food and how your food plan has kind of come to where it is today? What is it like, you know, from the beginning? What was it like from the beginning of recovery to what it's like now with your food?
Okay. It's my sponsor said, all right, Sam, try to just do three meals a day and nothing in between. So I did that and boy, they were three big meals. And then he said, all right, Sam, the next step is try to picture your last bite before your first bite. And what that did is that helped me put kind of a beginning and an ending point to my meal. And then from there, that kind of evolved into me using my food sponsor as my higher power. Because what I'll do is I'll think about what I'm going to eat. And if I feel, and I pause for a little bit, and if I don't get a feeling of dissonance, then that's what I eat. But if I do get that dissonance, that means, all right, time out. And I pray and say, please help me figure out what to eat. And I don't know how or why it works, but it does. And I mean, I have a science background. I was a pharmacy major. So scientifically, this makes no sense at all. But I do get that message. And the other thing I did is I have a consult with a nutritionist who helps me with my exercise and my food choices to maintain my diabetes at a healthy level. And I refrained from those foods that basically that I put in my mouth and I can't get out of my head. In terms of the weighing and measuring, sometimes I weigh and measure some of my proteins, but that's usually about it.
All right, put my hand up. Sorry.
No, go right. Absolutely, Eric. Go ahead.
Sam, thanks for your share. Just wanted to ask about potential ebbing and flowing in program with regards to, you know, maybe sometimes when you've felt a little bit less close with Flowgram and then kind of rebuilt that back up, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, thank you for asking that. I have had that where I don't know if I was on the pink cloud or what. When that happens, usually what will happen is something's going to happen to me and I get that really big feeling of dissonance and it'll stay with me longer. And when things stay with me longer, that's an indication that I have to start working my program even harder. And what's happened for me is that, you know, I started on one level and then, when you know, it worked for a while. And then when I would get, like you were saying, complacent or when something was really bothering me, I had to go to another level. And that's kind of been the evolution of my program is, you know, things will work for a while and then they won't. And then I have to go deeper and deeper. And that's why I say I am not a recovered compulsive overeater. I'm a recovering compulsive overeater. It's my journey. And even my relapse of 25 years was part of my journey. So that's why, you know, I don't really get hung up on the days that people have. As far as I'm concerned, whoever woke up the earliest has the most recovery today. And, you know, I can see everybody. It doesn't look like you're eating. So right now, you and I all are abstinent together.